Chapter 92. Finger and thumb, and chuck you away dead as I thought so doing. Odd times, when I see you loitering amongst the pollards on the Sunday, and you hadn't found no uncles then. No, not you. But when old Orlick come for to hear that your uncle Provis had most like wore the leg iron what old Orlick had picked up, filed asunder, on these meshes ever, so many year ago, and what he kept by him till he dropped your sister with it, like a bullock, as he means to drop you, hey. When he come for to hear that, hey. In his savage taunting, he flared the candle so close at me that I turned my face aside, to save it from the flame. Ah, he cried, laughing, after doing it again, the burnt child dreads the fire. Old Orlick knowed you was burnt, old Orlick knowed you was smuggling your uncle Provis away, old Orlick's a match for you, and knowed you'd come tonight. Now I'll tell you something more, Wolf, and this ends it. There's them that's as good a match for your uncle Provis as old Orlick has been for you. Let him wear them, when he's lost his nevy. Let him wear them, when no man can't find a rag of his dear relation's clothes, nor yet a bone of his body. There's them that can't, and that won't have Magwitch, yes, I know the name. Alive in the same land with them, and that's had such sure information of him, when he was alive in another land, as that he couldn't and shouldn't leave it unbeckoning, and put them in danger. Perhaps it's them that writes 50 hands, and that's not like sneaking you as writes but one. Where Compeyson, Magwitch, and the gallows? He flared the candle at me again, smoking my face and hair, and for an instant blinding me, and turned his powerful back as he replaced the light on the table. I had thought a prayer, and had been with Joanne, Biddy and Herbert, before he turned towards me again. There was a clear space of a few feet between the table and the opposite wall. Within this space, he now slouched backwards and forwards. His great strength seemed to sit stronger upon him than ever before, as he did this with his hands hanging loose and heavy at his sides, and with his eyes scowling at me. I had no grain of hope left. Wild as my inward hurry was, and wonderful the force of the pictures that rushed by me instead of thoughts, I could yet clearly understand that, unless he had resolved, that I was within a few moments of surely perishing out of all human knowledge, he would never have told me what he had told. Of a sudden, he stopped, took the cork out of his bottle, and tossed it away. Light as it was, I heard it fall like a plummet. He swallowed slowly, tilting up the bottle by little and little, and now he looked at me no more. The last few drops of liquor he poured into the palm of his hand, and licked up. Then, with a sudden hurry of violence and swearing horribly, he threw the bottle from him, and stooped, and I saw in his hand a stone hammer with a long heavy handle. The resolution I had made did not desert me, for, without uttering one vain word of appeal to him, I shouted out with all my might, and struggled with all my might. It was only my head and my legs that I could move, but to that extent I struggled with all the force, until then unknown, that was within me. In the same instant I heard responsive shouts, saw figures and a gleam of light dash in at the door, heard voices and tumult, and saw Orlick emerge from a struggle of men, as if it were tumbling water, clear the table at a leap, and fly out into the night. After a blank, I found that I was lying unbound, on the floor, in the same place, with my head on someone's knee. My eyes were fixed on the ladder against the wall, when I came to myself had opened on it before my mind saw it, and thus as I recovered consciousness, I knew that I was in the place, where I had lost it. Too indifferent at first, even to look round, and ascertain who supported me, I was lying looking at the ladder, when there came between me and it, a face. The face of Trapp's boy. "I think he's all right," said Trapp's boy, in a sober voice, "but ain't he just pale though?" At these words, the face of him who supported me looked over into mine, and I saw my supporter to be Herbert. "Great heaven!" "Softly," said Herbert. "Gently, Handel. Don't be too eager. And our old comrade, Startop," I cried, as he too bent over me. Remember what he is going to assist us in, said Herbert, and be calm. The illusion made me spring up, though I dropped again from the pain in my arm. The time has not gone by, Herbert, has it? What night is tonight? How long have I been here? For, I had a strange and strong misgiving that I had been lying there a long time a day and a night 2 days and nights more. The time has not gone by. It is still Monday night. Thank God. And you have all tomorrow, Tuesday, to rest in, said Herbert. But you can't help groaning, my dear Handel. What hurt have you got? Can you stand? Yes, yes, said I can walk. I have no hurt, but in this throbbing arm. They laid it bare, and did what they could. It was violently swollen and inflamed, and I could scarcely endure to have it touched. But, they tore up their handkerchiefs to make fresh bandages, and carefully replaced it in the sling, until we could get to the town, and obtain some cooling lotion to put upon it. In a little while we had shut the door of the dark and empty sluice house, and were passing through the quarry on our way back. Traps, boy, Traps, overgrown young man now went before us with a lantern, which was the light I had seen come in at the door. But, the moon was a good 2 hours higher than when I had last seen the sky, and the night, though rainy, was much lighter. The white vapor of the kiln was passing from us as we went by, and, as I had thought a prayer before, I thought a thanksgiving now. Entreating Herbert to tell me how he had come to my rescue, which at first he had flatly refused to do, but had insisted on my remaining quiet, I learned that I had in my hurry dropped the letter, open, in our chambers, where he, coming home to bring with him Startop, whom he had met in the street on his way to me, found it, very soon after I was gone. Its tone made him uneasy, and the more so, because of the inconsistency between it, and the hasty letter I had left for him. His uneasiness increasing instead of subsiding after a quarter of an hour's consideration, he set off for the coach office, with Startop, who volunteered his company, to make inquiry when the next coach went down. Finding that the afternoon coach was gone, and finding that his uneasiness grew into positive alarm, as obstacles came in his way, he resolved to follow in a postchaise. So, he and Startop arrived at the Blue Boar, fully expecting there to find me, or tidings of me. But, finding neither, went on to Miss Havisham's, where they lost me. Hereupon they went back to the hotel, doubtless at about the time when I was hearing the popular local version of my own story, to refresh themselves, and to get someone to guide them out upon the marshes. Among the loungers under the Boar's archway happened to be Traps Boy, true to his ancient habit of happening to be everywhere where he had no business, and Traps Boy had seen me passing from Miss Havisham's in the direction of my dining place. Thus, Traps Boy became their guide, and with him, they went out to the sluice house, though by the town way to the marshes, which I had avoided. Now, as they went along, Herbert reflected that I might, after all, have been brought there on some genuine and serviceable errand tending to Provis's safety, and, bethinking himself that in that case interruption must be mischievous, left his guide and Startop on the edge of the quarry, and went on by himself, and stole round the house 2 or 3 times, endeavoring to ascertain whether all was right within. As he could hear nothing but indistinct sounds of one deep rough voice, this was while my mind was so busy, he even at last began to doubt whether I was there, when suddenly I cried out loudly, and he answered the cries, and rushed in, closely followed by the other two. When I told Herbert what had passed within the house, he was for our immediately going before a magistrate in the town, late at night as it was, and getting out a warrant. But, I had already considered that such a course, by detaining us there, or binding us to come back, might be fatal to Provis. There was no gainsaying this difficulty, and we relinquished all thoughts of pursuing Orlick at that time. For the present, under the circumstances, we deemed it prudent to make rather light of the matter to Traps Boy, who I am convinced would have been much affected by disappointment if he had known that his intervention saved me from the Limicon. Not that Trap's boy was of a malignant nature, but that he had too much spare vivacity, and that it was in his constitution to want variety and excitement at anybody's expense. When we parted, I presented him with 2 guineas which seemed to meet his views, and told him that I was sorry ever to have had an ill opinion of him which made no impression on him at all. Wednesday being so close upon us, we determined to go back to London that night, 3 in the postchaise, the rather, as we should then be clear away before the night's adventure began to be talked of. Herbert got a large bottle of stuff for my arm, and by dint of having this stuff dropped over it all the night through, I was just able to bear its pain on the journey. It was daylight when we reached the Temple, and I went at once to bed, and lay in bed all day. My terror, as I lay there, of falling ill, and being unfitted for tomorrow, was so besetting, that I wonder it did not disable me of itself. It would have done so, pretty surely, in conjunction with the mental wear and tear I had suffered, but for the unnatural strain upon me that tomorrow was so anxiously looked forward to, charged with such consequences, its results so impenetrably hidden though so near. No precaution could have been more obvious than our refraining from communication with him that day, yet this again increased my restlessness. I started at every footstep and every sound, believing that he was discovered and taken, and this was the messenger to tell me so. I persuaded myself that I knew he was taken, that there was something more upon my mind than a fear or presentiment, that the fact had occurred, and I had a mysterious knowledge of it. As the day wore on, and no ill news came, as the day closed in and darkness fell, my overshadowing dread of being disabled by illness before tomorrow morning altogether mastered me. My burning arm throbbed, and my burning head throbbed, and I fancied I was beginning to wander. I counted up to high numbers, to make sure of myself, and repeated passages that I knew in prose and verse. It happened sometimes that in the mere escape of a fatigued mind, I dozed for some moments or forgot. Then I would say to myself with a start, "Now it has come, and I am turning delirious." They kept me very quiet all day, and kept my arm constantly dressed, and gave me cooling drinks. Whenever I fell asleep, I awoke with the notion I had had in the sluice house, that a long time had elapsed and the opportunity to save him was gone. About midnight I got out of bed, and went to Herbert, with the conviction that I had been asleep for 24 hours, and that Wednesday was past. It was the last self-exhausting effort of my fretfulness, for, after that, I slept soundly. Wednesday morning was dawning when I looked out of window. The winking lights upon the bridges were already pale, the coming sun was like a marsh of fire on the horizon. The river, still dark and mysterious, was spanned by bridges that were turning coldly gray, with here and there atop a warm touch from the burning in the sky. As I looked along the clustered roofs, with church towers and spires shooting into the unusually clear air, the sun rose up, and a veil seemed to be drawn from the river, and millions of sparkles burst out upon its waters. From me too, a veil seemed to be drawn, and I felt strong and well. Herbert lay asleep in his bed, and our old fellow student lay asleep on the sofa. I could not dress myself without help, but I made up the fire, which was still burning, and got some coffee ready for them. In good time they too started up strong and well, and we admitted the sharp morning air at the windows, and looked at the tide that was still flowing towards us. "When it turns at 9 o'clock, said Herbert, cheerfully, "look out for us, and stand ready, you over there at Mill Pond Bank." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.